trees, same shadows.
Welcome to Bending the Arc. Bending the Arc is a show of the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition and offered here on Community Radio KKRN. I'm your host, Sharon Brizolera. And as you know, on this show, we talk to a range of people who are interested in some aspect of criminal legal reform. I have the privilege of speaking today to Jake Snow of the ACLU, and we're going to be talking about surveillance, an issue that here locally we've been very concerned about. So welcome, Jake.
Thanks, Sharon. It's so great to be here.
So we always begin with letting people introduce themselves in whatever way they feel is important or however they would like to ground our conversation.
Great. Hello. My name is Jake Snow. I am a senior staff attorney at the ACLU of Northern California, and I use he/him pronouns, and I work at the intersection of technology and civil rights. So for the ACLU of Northern California, that means working on government surveillance, how the government tracks people, both in the criminal legal system and outside of it, consumer privacy, which is people's privacy vis-a-vis companies or other private actors. And then third, free speech online, the ability for people to speak up in online environments like social media or on the internet and make sure that their voices are heard to the greatest extent possible. And so it's great to be here and looking forward to the discussion.
How long have you been with the ACLU and how did you get into this particular focus of work? It's huge. It's a huge area that includes AI, right? And all of those things that we're currently concerned about.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, yeah, I've been at the ACLU of Northern California for about 8 years now. And so I started, midway through the first Trump administration. And I got into that work after being a lawyer working at the intersection of technology and law for quite a long time. I was at a law firm doing patent and intellectual property litigation. And then I was at the Federal Trade Commission in San Francisco doing a kind of mix of stuff where there was always some connection to technology as well. So consumer protection cases or privacy cases that have a technological aspect to them. And I did that work for about 5 years with the Federal Trade Commission. And then 8 years ago, came over to the ACLU to focus on, civil rights and the intersection with technology there. I've been thinking, I feel like, for my whole career about how technology, whether it's IP or privacy or false advertising, or civil rights impacts people in the real world and what that means for their lived experience, and trying to do legal work that puts in place protections that can really make people's lives better. And so to me, that's the through line from all the work that I've done, but it certainly is kind of most directly applicable in the work that I've done at the ACLU.
How much do you interact with the public about issues?
Yeah, I mean, I would say a fair amount. I mean, we do litigation, so we prepare cases for litigation, and we bring those cases. When we file cases, we will often, have a press release or a blog post or perhaps a video that tries to communicate to the public what it is that we're trying to achieve in that case, why it's important, who our clients are, what the impact of them has been on the technology that we're looking at. And so it certainly happens in litigation context. And then we also do a lot of policy work around the country, obviously with a focus on California, that looks at what rules should be in place for privacy, government surveillance, AI systems, and other areas, free speech online as well. And in those efforts, we communicate to members of the legislature through, letters and conversations, but we also will show up to testify publicly in hearings. In those communications with the legislature and with informational hearings or public testimony, we're both communicating to policymakers and decision makers about what we think the right priorities and policies should be to protect people, but also thinking about members of the public who are interested in those issues coming to those hearings or seeing those communications and learning about an issue and understanding how the ACLU thinks about an issue that they already care about. And so it's kind of a combination of both speaking to the public and speaking to policymakers. And so, you know, I personally think that keeping them in mind how to communicate about the work that we do to the public and why it matters to the public is both helpful to help the public kind of know what's going on, but it's also helpful to us because it grounds our work in people's real experience. And when you always think about how to tell people it matters, it actually guides you towards doing work that matters. And so I think that's a really helpful sort of guidepost, if you will, for the work that we do more broadly.
Yeah. With everything that's happening currently, what's the level of engagement around these issues? You know, certainly there are many of us, you know, here who are very concerned about all kinds of surveillance, but we also have so many issues where we're not really hearing what that level of engagement or concern is. What are you finding either here in California or, you know, in particular, people that have impact in the North State?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that there are a few issues that are you know, capturing the attention of policymakers in California. And anytime you have an issue that captures attention of policymakers, but also the public, I mean, I think the public and policymakers kind of like move in some ways in lockstep on how much an issue matters, you have an opportunity to advance goals that are directly, you know, sort of connected to that. To that area of concern, and then also, you know, things that maybe aren't as connected. And let me just like, you know, talk about some examples. You know, a lot of concern about artificial intelligence, the impact of artificial intelligence on the workplace, on our lives, each of us as workers in various sectors and industries. And you know, there I think you have an opportunity to say like, this is a particular threat. Or a particular category of harm, you know, also some promise for helping people do work that in ways that they value more. And so you can talk to members about that, and you can say, like, here are the ways that we can put in place restrictions or guidelines or what have you. And those restrictions can both address the sort of concrete harm that people are imagining, but also they can just like strengthen foundational rights in a more fundamental way. And I think it's worth thinking about both of those approaches as we do the work. And, you know, we certainly do that at the ACLU when we engage in policy discussions. The two other areas that I would flag are protecting kids online. A lot of concern about kids and devices, kids and social media. And, you know, there we have looked, you know, a little bit skeptically about the bills that are being discussed with respect to putting in place age limits on online sources that would prohibit adults from accessing those materials unless they are willing to submit a government ID to a website. And then we've offered other solutions to the same sort of category of problems in the form of really strong privacy laws that benefit everyone, but also undermine the you know, deeper business model of encouraging people to engage as much as possible with various online environments, whether it's social media or artificial intelligence systems or what have you. And so, you know, undermining the like deeper privacy invasive business model instead of limiting speech is the way that we've spoken about those. And so, you know, in both of those categories, I think there's an eye to addressing the concrete immediate problem before us in California. And then also thinking about ways that, you know, social justice and people's flourishing can be advanced by putting in place better restrictions that are good for everyone.
Often when I'm talking to people, there's kind of a group of people who are very concerned and the privacy is really important and the distrust of what are they doing with that information. And then you have a group of people who are like, I have nothing to hide. You know, I'm a law-abiding citizen and we should have more of this, you know, to quote unquote, you know, catch the bad guys. And without, and that group of people tends to be less concerned about or maybe not looking into as much the potential harm for themselves or others. So I'm wondering what you've encountered and how you tend to address those perspectives.
Yeah. You know, it's as somebody who works in the privacy field and has done so for a while, the notion of having nothing to hide is something that, you know, it's a point that, you know, we hear a lot when we say that privacy protections are important. And, you know, to me, it does reflect a reasonable response to the way that that people think about privacy. And they think of it as being something that, you know, if you want to keep something a secret, then privacy is important to you. And you would only want to keep something a secret if you're doing something wrong. I think that's kind of an intuitive way to think about it, but I do think that it's mistaken. and the reason I think that is that, you know, in this day and age, we can see that groups that are being targeted, people that are being targeted for totally law-abiding or even like honorable behavior, are put at risk by the weak privacy protections that we have in place. So, you know, example of that is people who are coming to the United States to work. They are potentially here legally. They're seeking asylum. They have some kind of protection for their presence in the United States. And they are nevertheless being targeted for tracking, surveillance, sometimes violence, sometimes being detained and deported, using information that has been gathered about them as they like go about their lives or go about their internet, their lives on the internet, or drive their cars, you know, through a network of automated license plate reader cameras. And so all that surveillance technology is targeting those people, and they may have nothing to hide, but they have a lot to lose. And that is why the privacy protections that, you know, we talk about when it comes to limiting the surveillance of people going about their lives is so important. You know, one other example of that is in the wake of the Dobbs decision in the Supreme Court, there are now states that are criminalized abortion. Abortion is in California a fundamental constitutional right that cannot be undermined by California law, but it is also a crime in other states of the United States. And so you have this situation where it's a crime in one state, it's an absolutely inviolable constitutional fundamental right in California. And, you know, people might want to come to California to seek reproductive health care or gender affirming care. And in doing that, the surveillance that is happening either in their state or in California could undermine their ability to do that. You know, those people have nothing to hide sort of in terms of anything they're doing that's ethical. You know, they're just trying to have control over their own bodies and their own lives. But the surveillance that is happening is being used against them. And so privacy is valuable for them as well. So that's kind of the first thing, is to think about how having something to hide isn't the same thing as not being vulnerable or impacted by surveillance. And the second thing I would add is that I think all of us need to take a close look at what kinds of interventions are actually helpful at addressing the problems that we see around us, either in our communities or in, you know, California or the United States more broadly. And in particular, I think a lot of ideas about how surveillance helps to address, for example, threats to public safety, or, you know, we see disorder, we see crimes happening, we don't like that, we want to stop it. We see the people harmed by those acts, and we don't like them, and we want to stop them. And then the next step is to say, well, if we would keep a record of all the people who might have been doing that, and then we can identify them, and then that we can criminally prosecute them. We have to have we have to look at the question of whether that is actually effective at reducing crime. And it turns out that taking people and incarcerating them, increasing the severity of punishment, doesn't actually do very much to reduce crime. And in fact, in the United States, incarcerating people can cause them to commit more crimes because they go into a system that mistreats them and that can sometimes result in people coming out of an incarceration situation more likely to commit a crime in the future. That is a horrible thing. It is a sad and fact about the criminal legal system in the United States, but it also should change how we think about surveillance law and policy, and whether we think that those approaches are the right one to address the problems that we all see and that we all want to address.
You're listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN. This is our conversation with ACLU of Northern California lawyer Jake Snow.
I will say that I grew up in Grass Valley in California, so not a little bit north, a little bit south of Redding, but I certainly know I have lots of friends and folks who know Redding. I have friends from Redding, I've been there lots of times, I know sort of the situation, and I will say there is both the political stuff around immigration and immigrants' rights, people's rights to reproductive care, that are important and that really do, I think, make a case for limited surveillance of people. But on the sort of private side, we are seeing a lot of efforts to take information gathered by private entities and use that to set the prices that people pay in their everyday lives. And so, this is the label that has been put on this is surveillance pricing. And, you can just imagine if you are going through, you go to your local Safeway and you look at a tag on, a box of paper towels, and you look at it, and then it calculates, and then it gives you the price just for you. And maybe that's because it knows that you have, family at home, and so you really need paper towels, or you really need diapers, or what have you. You really need formula, right? What's the price that a parent is going to pay for the formula they need for their kids? That's going to be higher than someone else. And so the idea that somebody could be exploited to pay more for formula for their child because the store knows they have a baby it's horrifying, to be honest, from my perspective. But it also, I think, shows something that is the harms of surveillance. That is, it's true for everyone. I mean, doesn't matter your political alliances. You understand that using that information to, exploit a new mom, for example, is a terrible thing. Now, what I think a lot of folks would say is, oh, well, it's people get lower prices and maybe they get higher prices, but it's mostly for discounts. From my perspective, that information should sort of be limited in using it to set prices at all, because otherwise you open the door to those kinds of horrifying things, which are to target people not because they have the resources to pay for something, but because they desperately need it and they're vulnerable. And I think that's what surveillance sometimes does, is to allow people to be targeted because they're vulnerable, and that's what we're trying to stop.
Yeah. And it's interesting because sometimes you hear people who feel, I don't shop on Amazon, but we're all interacting in a number of ways that gather information about us. No one is immune from this kind of data gathering.
Yeah. And the other thing to highlight for folks, and to me, this was something that was hard to wrap my head around, but if I go to a store and, I have a loyalty card, for example, because I want to get the lower price when I go grocery shopping. That gathers information about me. They know what I'm buying. That is a form of pricing based on information about me. But what can happen, is that if I, if I browse the internet, let's say I'm looking to buy a blender, I look at very different kinds of blenders. I read articles about which blenders are the best. Then that information from the internet can then be purchased or can be gathered by a grocery store that would be wanting to know more information about who's shopping there, what they want to buy. And so that connection between what you're doing online and what you're looking at on your phone and the real world experience of shopping in a grocery store might feel very disconnected. But because the data flows those data connections can happen, they are not disconnected. And so, as you point out, the surveillance can happen to people even in ways that, might not be immediately apparent. And I sort of think it's not immediately apparent because it's being concealed. Mm-hmm. And so people should be aware of that.
I lost my home in the car fire, one of our, wildfires here, and talking to the insurance agencies and going to all kinds of, meetings, but that they're even, you know, back then, so it's 2018, have a lot of data on what people will settle for based on their stage in life. So if you're a couple with kids, you need that higher level. You're going to replace a lot more than someone who's 50 or 60. They kind of know your point at which you'll say, sure, that's fine.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's, and you know, in the insurance industry, you know, we're seeing a real push to price people's insurance based on their driving patterns, like whether they, you know, like install these devices in people's cars and like if they brake a lot, then, that might make their insurance rates go up. And so that kind of surveillance pricing is finding its way into all different industries, including insurance and, I mean, like, you know, rental housing. There was a whole lawsuit in Florida about using people's personal information to set their rent, using not necessarily personal information, but non-public information to set rent. And you know, that was a case brought by the United States Justice Department under President Biden. And so this pattern of using information to like change the price that consumers pay in a way that I think is fundamentally exploitative, is showing up in a lot of different areas.
And, you know, I'm aware of many of the things that I use that can be collecting data from me. What should we know about AI searches on different platforms and what they're collecting on us there, and who has access to that data? Is that also things that are being sold to?
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing about a lot of the large language model systems, whether it's OpenAI and ChatGPT or Anthropic or Google or X or other models, is that they are fairly new products, and so understanding exactly how those data flows work and what the data protections are, how that information is being used, is something we do not know for sure. You know, all those companies will have privacy policies. Those privacy policies will be, you know, pretty difficult to parse if you are a privacy lawyer like I am, but they will even be even more difficult to parse, I would assume, if you're not one.
Yeah.
The way that that information is being used is not fully known. And so, you know, I think a certain amount of skepticism is appropriate. But then the second thing is that, you know, these companies are currently in the phase where they're building a product and they're trying to get as many people to use it as possible. And then the sort of next step is to figure out how to make money from it. You know, we have seen this pattern happen before with the social media companies, which started out with just getting people to come in to social media platforms, you know, start relying on them to connect with their family, their friends, to find out about local events, to invite people to parties. Like, all of those things were built into the social media platforms. And then, you know, advertising was added into it. And so the thing that I think we should all be thinking about is not just like what those privacy policies say today, what they don't say today, but also what the future business model of these platforms will do to the information that's being collected. And, you know, whether all those privacy policies are going to be held to, or whether there's room inside of them to do something else with the data that we wouldn't approve of. Mm-hmm. And I would just note one example, because I think it's so, it's a good example of this pattern, which is there was a company called EverAlbum, which made a photo sharing application, compiling and sharing application, storage and sharing application, in like 2017, by having that photo storage application, gathered like millions and I think billions of photographs, and then used all of those photographs from people to train a facial recognition system that they then marketed to the federal government and to the military as surveillance technology. And so it's like you just see this pipeline where it goes from people's pictures of their kids at a birthday party running facial recognition on those systems, building a new facial recognition system based on that huge training corpus of images, and then having that training corpus and that algorithm be built and sold to the military for to surveil populations in a sort of dragnet way. And then the next step was that the photo sharing application went away. And so it goes from consumer app to military surveillance tech, and you just see the pipeline go straight through. And that is a problem, obviously. But also, you know, going back to the very beginning, like, those people never had a chance to decide whether the pictures of their birthday party should be the raw material of military surveillance technology. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of them, and you know, I think they either should have been given the choice to decide, or it should just be outright prohibited, because giving people, or putting the burden on people to decide if that's a permissible use of their pictures, it seems like you're giving people the choice as a way of overwhelming their sort of like decision making, and pushing that through as a way that of using people's information that's allowed. And I think privacy protection should be stronger than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and back to your earlier point about, you know, immigration, we're seeing, I can think of, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, we're thinking like, oh yeah, well, that's a potential danger, but that'll never happen. And all those things are happening in terms of tracing people and people without criminal records.
Yeah. I mean, it has been, it's an interesting time to be, working in privacy and surveillance, because, it does feel like recent history where we were saying what you just referred to, which is, you know, just imagine if this information was put in the hands of a violent and repressive government bent on targeting immigrants and, you know, people of color, reproductive health care, and you know, like, just using that information to harm them to commit violence against them. And having people say, yeah, okay, civil libertarians, civil rights activists, like, you know, always concerned about these sorts of futures, but how realistic is that? and here we are. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully there's a book in your future, Jake. You know, one of the reasons we originally reached out was, conversations happening here about the automated license plate readers. Yeah. And so, you know, before we jump into that, if you could explain to listeners what they are, what they do, and what they don't do. Yeah. And then we'll jump into the rest.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, an automated license plate reader is, fundamentally, it's a camera on a pole, that takes pictures of cars, and then identifies their license plate, and then adds that license plate to a database. And, you know, they work in different ways. Sometimes they have other things that are built into them. You know, sometimes they might record live video all the time, sometimes not. But that's sort of the fundamental thing. And what that results in is a data set that effectively represents a whole community and population's movements over time as they go about their lives. And so, you know, there are places where there are so many, and there's lots of places like this, where there's so many hundreds and hundreds of cameras inside of a city or a town. And so, you know, a person can't go to the grocery store or to the local, you know, bar, or to a medical appointment, or to see a friend, or to a political rally, or anything without having their movements captured, recorded, and maintained in a database that is accessible to law enforcement. And so, you know, that's what automated license plate readers are, is they sort of collect that information and then make it searchable by law enforcement. And, you know, it's not just local law enforcement, and we'll probably talk more about this, but it also raises the possibility that law enforcement elsewhere in California, and even in other states and in the federal government, could also query and access that information and find people in California where they live, or wherever they might have gone. And so that's the real threat to privacy and civil rights that we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Is that permissible now?
Yeah. So there is a law. It's called SB 34. That law prohibits license plate reader data in possession of government entities in California from being shared with other states or with the federal government.
Including ICE,
including the Department of Homeland Security. It prohibits sharing. Essentially, you can think of think of it as putting a wall at the borders of the state of California. It can't go outside of California, but it does allow sharing inside of California.
Other counties. And,
yeah, that's right. So that has been the law. I think it's 2015 or so when that was passed, but it was around that time. And that law has it is possible to bring a lawsuit to enforce it. And in fact, ACLU, NorCal, other folks on my team brought a lawsuit against Marin County, I think, to enforce SB 34. And since then, we have heard of many tens, I think it's like something like 75 or 80 at this point, counties that have been sharing information in violation of SB 34 with the federal government or with other states. That sharing has been effectively like encouraged by various automated license plate reader vendors, whether it's Vigilant or more recently Flock has been a license plate, automated license plate reader vendor that folks have probably heard about. And that sharing has been enabled by those platforms, which, you know, are trying to get law enforcement to sign up for their service and probably marketing them on searching the license plate reader records of other places where that platform is also operational. Now, the thing that I think is really important to recognize about this is the law prohibits that sharing. And yes, for years, we have continued to hear about more and more and more of these counties in California and cities that are sharing in violation of the law. We have gone so far as to bring a lawsuit to stop it. And we've sent letters to a lot of those localities who have been doing that sharing. The Attorney General of California has issued an opinion saying it is prohibited under SB 34 to share in this way. So it's not like there's an ambiguity in the law and it's not clear that it's a violation. It's definitely a violation. And yet, even this year, we have heard of more violations of that law where localities are sharing with the federal government. And to me, that shows that holding this information is too dangerous to tolerate. Because even if you have a law saying, oh, well, we're going to like limit the sharing with the federal government in this way, for whatever reason, maybe it's because enforcement needs to be stronger, or it's because the platforms that are running the automated license plate reader systems are encouraging the sharing. But for whatever reason, the law as it exists does not stop people, stop localities from sharing. And so just holding that data, even with a law that prohibits sharing, is too dangerous to do. And so, you can think of it as being sort of similar to toxic waste. It's something that should not exist. And so that fact that there's a law, it prohibits it, and yet it's not being complied with over many years, tells us something about what the right answer is at a policy level to address this kind of surveillance.
You're listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN. This is our conversation with ACLU of Northern California lawyer Jake Snow. Yeah, are you seeing any pattern in the entities that are doing the sharing?
So I don't think that there is anything where external agencies are compelling access to that data, because I think they can just get it by effectively buying it. As far as patterns in who is doing that sharing, I mean, there have been so many that it's hard to identify a pattern. Sure. It would be interesting, though, I haven't done this, but it's a good question. And it would be interesting to look back at all of those violations that are on the record and to say, like, you know, what are the kinds of localities that we're seeing is this happening most often? And I don't know the answer to that, but, I'll try to take a look, because I think it's a really, good question.
I have a couple of different questions about those automated license plate readers. So one thing that you hear in the news a lot is that when it comes up that, but it doesn't catch your face, right? It's the, it's not capturing any, you know, facial recognition. So I'm wondering both, is that true? And whether or not it's true, what might that be obscuring about what is being collected?
Yeah. So, here I want to also say that, you know, we do not know how these systems work inside of the platforms or the cameras themselves. And so, you know, it might be that, that many such cameras don't do facial recognition as a like first step when they capture an image of an automobile or when they capture a video of an automobile. That does not mean that one, faces are not visible in the photos. And it does not mean that those faces could not be recognized either retrospectively or in the image in a situation when it's shared with law enforcement in some way. And so if you have a picture of someone's, if you have a picture of someone's face, then that picture, exposes the person to a risk of identification through an automated means, as long as that picture is held by the government. So, if they hold it for a year, then in 9 months, anyone, including, ICE or the Department of Homeland Security, could go back and say, do you have any pictures of this person in your database? And one could imagine that would be something that could be searched at the local level, at least as a technical ability to do that. Then there's the practical question of whether those systems have been built. And I don't think we know as much as we'd like to about how exactly those systems are functioning today. So that's the sort of first step is we don't know, but it's technically possible. The second step is that I think it's pretty cold comfort to say that somebody's face is not being recognized in real time as they drive around when you have their license plate and when, the data brokers that are available, the people search websites and such, will tell you who is the, registered owner of a car. And maybe even information about who else is in a family of the person who is the registered owner of a car. And so, it may be that it's not recognizing your face and they might not know that in that moment a particular person is driving a car, but there's a pretty strong inference. From my perspective, if the movement of my automobile, which I share, indicates my location, and it might also be used to target or grab somebody in my family when they are driving that automobile somewhere. That's just as scary as it would be as if it was used against me. And so, we share automobiles and we drive, with our friends, our family, but our loved ones, members of our community. And so, that anonymity, if you'd even call it that, which I would not call it that, it's not very reassuring because it would mean that, those people are put at risk as well. And that's a pretty scary thought.
Yeah. Have there been any cases where that kind of information that, you were seen or your car was seen at this particular area and there's no other verification of where the person might have been? Have there been any cases where that has had a lot of weight in a criminal case?
Yeah, I haven't seen the question of how reliable it is an indicator of someone's location that their license plate was identified at a particular place. How much does that say about whether that person was there or was it just somebody else driving their car? I think that would be in the criminal legal system. It would probably be a case by case assessment where you're sure. Looking at people's patterns and their testimony and such. But when it comes to those systems and their accuracy, even if they, they don't always accurately recognize the license plates. And I think that does really put people at risk. There's a memorable to me, Business Insider story called Flock Flocked Up. And it talks about how a mistaken identification of a man named Brandon Upchurch resulted in their telling, unraveling this man's life because of this incorrect identification using an automated license plate reader system. It's a really well-told story and a scary one. I think it's easy to think that because we think about computers as being pretty good at just recognizing text, that you might think those are not all that common. But they definitely happen, and they have catastrophic consequences for people's lives.
are we as a jurisdiction paying for the technology that companies like Flock are keeping? You know, like we've seen so much initial pushback about body cams, like, well, that's a lot of data and we have to keep it and there's cost to that and going through it and whatnot. Is that similar with Flock technology?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think of those surveillance technologies as having a pretty like unestablished track record of actually improving people's lives. But, you know, they cost a lot of money for localities. A lot of times localities that don't have a ton of money to spend on contracts for procuring, you know, various products. And so, you know, they're building these networks, they're installing these cameras, they're running the software and the systems to gather this information. And then the next question is like, how much is that actually improving the lives of the people who live there? And I don't think they are. They certainly haven't proven their case for why they are improving the lives of people who live there. And that's why we have seen so much outcry in California when either these contracts are up for being entered into in the first place or when they're up for renewal. People are really, you know, standing up and saying like, this is not helpful. It's not worth the money. And it's also not helping to make people's lives better. And so we just shouldn't do it. And so, yeah, I think that's definitely happening. And it's there's an element of saying, look, like these systems aren't helping people. And so they shouldn't be bought in their name, in mm-hmm. the name of the public.
You're listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN. This is our conversation with ACLU of Northern California lawyer Jake Snow. Certainly having someone like the ACLU sue is a really critical element, but there are things that communities could do and have done. So I'm wondering if you could tell us about some of that and what you have seen or think could be effective in a community like ours.
Yeah. So a couple of things. You know, first of all, I think a key point at which it matters for people to speak up is at the city council and board of supervisors or local decision maker meetings where these contracts are being reviewed. You know, that's really where it matters because that is the point at which, you know, these elected representatives, you know, whether city council, county council, what have you, have to look the public in the face and say, this is why we're doing this. And this is why we're spending, you know, X, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars on these contracts. And when people speak up and say like, we don't want this and we don't want you to do this, it does make a difference and it can change the outcome. And so, you know, plugging into networks of people who are monitoring those meetings and then doing that organizing. And then when they ask for people to show up, you know, make an effort to do that because it really does matter in terms of the numbers of people who are present at those meetings, you know, whether it's even if they have like remote testimony, it really matters if there's 10 people or 20 people or, you know, 50 people. And that's not very many people in the grand scheme of things, but just those people who are willing to show up and say like, don't do this, I think makes a huge difference. The second thing, I would lift up examples of websites that are tracking and gathering information about cameras that exist. And, you know, they're like dflock.org is one, and they have a map. And I think they also allow people to add cameras to that map. And so you can look there and you can see this map of like all the cameras in the United States, including in California. And if you live in a community where these cameras are being added, or you live in a place where where you see that the cameras are present, but they're not on the map, you can add to it. And then that allows people in your community to see it, but also allows people around the country to see it. And just looking at it right now, there are 81,556 tracked cameras just in the Flock Safety brand around the United States. And, you know, I think that just tells you a huge amount about the level of surveillance that people in communities all around the country are under. You know, almost 100,000, close to getting near 100,000 cameras tracking people's whereabouts and what they're doing as they go about their lives is a lot, and it puts people at risk. And so adding local cameras that folks see to that resource, I think is a good step as well.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen any other forms of resistance that are legal? What other effective strategies, if any, have you seen or that one might consider?
Well, in San Jose, the ACLU of Northern California, working with partners at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, have filed a lawsuit against the city of San Jose for their Flock network. You know, when we filed our lawsuit, that is not my particular case, but when we filed our lawsuit, there were, I think, over 400 cameras in San Jose, and they had a retention period for that data of a year. And so, you know, that was really concerning from a privacy and civil rights perspective. And so we filed a lawsuit there. That case is still ongoing. And they also made some changes to their systems, I think, as a result of the lawsuit. But I do think that the legal approach is one worthwhile thing to consider. You know, this is an issue that is percolating through the courts. And so we filed a case in San Jose. There have been other cases filed around the country, some other cases in California. And, you know, all of those cases are going to start to figure out how to draw the line under the constitutional limits in California and then some other cases at the federal level to figure out what is a violation and what is not. And so, you know, I think it's worth considering that as an approach, but it is something that courts are considering. You know, there's a strategic decision as to, you know, whether to file now or file later, if you have concerns about a particular locality. Certainly keep an eye on those cases if folks, you know, have the legal expertise to understand that or can consult with a lawyer who can, give them some guidance.
We know some lawyers.
Yeah, we're good.
Is there any pending legislation that we should be attuned to on these issues?
There are some cases that bills that relate to automated license plate readers. I have to say that sitting here today, I don't know the number, the bill numbers, so.
We can look those up.
Yeah, so you can look those up. For me, there's like a fairly strong law in California, which is SB 34, which we already discussed. Mm-hmm. And so, when you look at additional legislative protections, you know, I think you have to think about that history of violations that we saw with SB 34 and how to address that in any new legislation. Mm-hmm. So that would be the additional lens that I would add to looking at future possible legislation in this area.
To circle back to something that you had said earlier about, you know, facial recognition, I know in the earlier days, there was a lot of concern about the inherent bias in how those systems were trained. And my sense, again, I'm not in this, you know, field, that there's been a lot more training and there's been suggestions that those systems have gotten better at features. But what should we know about the current state of facial recognition technology?
Yeah. So, back in 2018, we at the ACLU of Northern California did a study where we tested Amazon's facial recognition service. We actually gathered a set of, I think 20,000 mugshots from a public source and then ran every current member of Congress back then, all 535 members of Congress, through facial recognition for those mugshots. And we found that it was something like 26 false matches with mugshots, false matches, not anyone who had actually been arrested or in contact with law enforcement. Got some attention at the time, and it disproportionately falsely recognized people of color in Congress at the time, a lot of members of Congressional Black Caucus, including late civil rights legend, John Lewis. Mm. That got some attention and really, I think showed people how it could be dangerous to have these systems used in this way. As you say, the people who are making those systems now do tests to purportedly establish whether or not there's any kind of bias across gender or skin color lines, and they say that there has been improvement. It may well be the case that some of those models have improved, but there is still the possibility that some models will have better results and others will not have as good results. And you know, you don't know which of those systems is being used in a particular place for a particular system. And so as a result of that, you know, it may be that some models are better, but what matters is which model is being used for a particular system. And, you know, do we know whether that model is going to have false matches or not? And then the last thing I would say about just the false match situation or the consideration is that, you know, the technology is dangerous when it fails, but it's also dangerous when it works, right? And so it's like, do you want to be, you could have a false not match and that could protect you from being, you know, pulled out of your car at a traffic stop and it's sent to immigration detention by an ICE officer. And so, you know, it's dangerous when it works and it's dangerous when it doesn't. And so, you know, it's not that the bias is not an important consideration, but we're just seeing the harms of surveillance technology, you know, when it never sleeps and, you know, never misses, that puts people at risk as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jake, I really appreciate all of your work and what ACLU is doing. And is there a particular place on your site that you'd like to send people? We could put it in our show notes too, if they're interested in learning more.
Yeah. So we released a report called Seeing Through Surveillance. It's called Seeing Through Surveillance, Why Policymakers Should Look Past the Hype. And it makes a lot of the points that, unsurprisingly, makes a lot of the points that I've made in our discussion today, including that surveillance doesn't necessarily result in benefits to public safety, that there are disproportionate harms to marginalized communities based on the pervasiveness of surveillance technology. And we also have a whole bunch of resources in this report that tell people how to engage in their communities and to push back on surveillance technology, including things like policies that could be put in place to limit nefarious or you know, concerning uses, letters to send to city councils or county councils to push back on adopting surveillance technology, and more information about how this all works. And so that's the report that I would direct people to. And it, I think, is a template, and it's meant to be this for how people in localities can push back against surveillance technology. And so that's where I would direct people, and I'll send you a link so that you can include it in the show notes, and really appreciate you doing
Perfect.
That.
Perfect. Any last words or anything I should have asked you that you would like to share?
You know, the last thing I would like to talk about is something that's not so much about the government surveilling people in the first instance, but making use of private surveillance. Over the last 9 months, we have seen a whole bunch of what are called administrative subpoenas sent to social media platforms that seek to unmask people on those platforms who are speaking out against the current administration, in particular the current administration's immigration enforcement efforts that people think of as being, you know, horrifying and harmful. And so what's happened is that the Department of Homeland Security has sent, according to New York Times, hundreds of administrative subpoenas to social media platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, Twitter or X, Google, and Reddit, to unmask people who are speaking out against the government's actions. We have filed four cases in California to stop those social media platforms from turning over the information by quashing. That's the legal term for invalidating a subpoena. And we've been successful in stopping a whole bunch of those. And so, you know, to me, that's another area where the government is using existing authority, but it's using it in ways that it is not allowed to use to target people and to track people online as they speak out. And to me, it's a tactic meant to intimidate people into not speaking out against the government. And that's a real harm to people's First Amendment rights, as well as their privacy rights. And so that's one other area that I think is important for folks to know about. If people are speaking out in that way, they might get an email notice from the platform, whether it's Instagram, Facebook, X, Reddit, saying that the government has requested your information. And if people get that kind of notice, they can go to the ACLU of Northern California's website and submit an intake form, and we can take a look at that notice and see if there's anything that they can do to protect themselves. In some of those cases, it is urgent, and they have a short turnaround, so it's good to take that action and go to our intake form quickly when people receive the notice. But if they get one, we'd be interested in hearing from people because we're trying to track those cases and those abuses of subpoenas.
We will definitely share that. Jake, I really appreciate you being with us. Thank you for everything you're doing to help keep us safe and informed.
Thanks a lot, Jaron. It's a great conversation. Really enjoyed it. And yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Supported Radio.
Remember these. I can't let go. Remind me, please. Who am I, though? I don't believe I can let go. No, I can't let go. No, I can't let go. I can't get high and I can't get low. I cannot say and I cannot go. I can't say yes and I can't say no. I can't hold on and I can't let go.
Our theme music is provided by Jacob Akana. You can find Jacob's music everywhere that good music is sold.
Let go. No, I can't let go.